This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As the holiday season kicks off, there's a new term being bounced around this year, Thanksgivica. And maybe someone's even wished you a happy Hanukkah. It's all referring to the fact that the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah starts tonight, on Thanksgiving Eve. It's due to an odd confluence of dates on both the Gregorian and the ancient Jewish calendars, an event that won't happen again for a long, long time. And so some people of the Jewish faith are considering making butternut squash latkes or buying menorkes, 8-candled menorahs shaped, yes, like a turkey. But while these modern adaptations of an ancient celebration have stirred a lot of conversation, kitchen innovation, and even some consternation, in fact, Hanukkah has always been, for American Jews anyway, a uniquely interpreted holiday. As each generation of Jewish immigrants arrived from the Old World, the Festival of Lights offered them a bit of help in resolving the ambiguity of being a small religious minority in a dominant Christian culture. This idea of Hanukkah as an evolving vehicle for American Jewish identity is the theme of a new book that we're talking about today. It's called Hanukkah in America, A History. The author is with us, Diane Ashton, a professor of religious studies at Rowan University. We're also joined by Rabbi Robin Nafshi of Temple Beth Jacob in Concord, and let's hear from you. If you're Jewish, how much do you celebrate Hanukkah? How has it evolved in your own family? Do you think, like Christmas, the Festival of Lights has become too commercialized? And will you be observing Thanksgivica this year? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Professor Ashton joins us by phone from Rowan University in New Jersey. Professor Ashton, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
And Rabbi Robin Nafshi of Temple Beth Jacob in Concord is with me in studio. And Rabbi Nafshi, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura. It's great to be on the show.
Well, let's just start with the basics before we get into some of this really interesting history that Diane writes about. And Rabbi Nafshi, most people know about the menorah and the candles, and maybe they know about the latkes and so forth. But what is Hanukkah really all about?
Well, there are two different stories of Hanukkah. There's the way we celebrate it and what it has historically evolved into, and then it's the actual history that, of course, Professor Ashton writes about in her book. So what we celebrate is comes out of a compilation of rabbinic teachings called the Talmud, in which we have this conversation talking about a miracle when the Jews defeated the Greeks and rededicated the temple around the year 164 BCE. And in that rededication and cleaning up, they found a small vial of oil that should have lasted only a day, and it lasted eight. And so we celebrate this eight-day-long festival with the lighting of candles. Completely made-up story by the rabbis, the ancient rabbis of some 2,000 years ago. Hanukkah historically is most likely had been a delayed celebration of an earlier fall festival called Sukkot. Sukkot is the fall harvest festival, and we still celebrate it today. If you ever see a Jewish community with a booth in their yard, that is the celebration of Sukkot. Probably Hanukkah commemorates a time when the Jews were at war with the Assyrian Greeks, and during the holiday of Sukkot, they were hiding in caves in the mountains and didn't get to celebrate it. And so when they rededicated the temple, they rededicated it for a week-long festival, as the festival of Sukkot had been celebrated. And in fact, in the Book of Maccabees, not canonized in the Hebrew Bible, but still text we turn to, it says very clearly that they celebrated for 8 days in the lichen-keeping of Sukkot. But we celebrate with the light and the festival that way today because we don't celebrate war victories. Jews are not people who focus on war and battle and fighting, and instead we'd rather focus on God's miracles and so reframing the holiday into something more palatable was appropriate. Secondly, why would you celebrate Sukkot twice in a year? So there was a need to sort of reframe it again. And there were certainly light festivals in the late time of the year. Every culture had one. You can go up into the Scandinavian countries, they have them. And so there was most likely some kind of a pagan light festival that made sense to sort of weave into the celebration because people were probably familiar with it.
Okay, so you can see my jaw dropping. This whole thing about Judah Maccabee and fighting and the elephants and coming back and the temple is destroyed and, oh my goodness, and how do we light the menorah? And all of a sudden there is this miracle. You're saying a lot of that's made up?
Well,
or elements of truth kind of patched together, or
the oil lasting 8 days is probably rabbinic creativity. I don't know that I want to call it made up, but we'll call it rabbinic creativity.
And tie in again the Sukkot.
So Sukkot is a fall festival in biblical times and temple times in particular. The Jews would go to Israel, go to Jerusalem, and bring the first offerings of their fall harvest. And today we celebrate it by building a booth or a sukkah in our yard, and we are thankful to God for the bounty that we have. Most of us are not farmers any longer, but we still use some of the original species to celebrate with symbolically. It's a fun festival. It comes right after the end of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so it gives us an opportunity to literally go outside the synagogue now and back into the world after our 10 days of internal retrospective and prayer. And so Sukkot really brings us back into the world. But as I said, there's no reason to celebrate it twice.
So let's make up something new.
So let's make up something new or creatively come up with something with a different spin.
Well, and Professor Ashton, I'm curious too, when you talk to people, when you did your research for the book, looking back over 200 years of American history, I'd love your thoughts too on what Rabbi Nafshi calls rabbinic creativity, this story of Judah Maccabee and the big battle and the temple being ruined and so forth. How did people sort of work with that over time in America?
Oh, people found this very inspirational, but different people did very different things with it. In fact, what I found is the first glimmer of Hanukkah beginning to take on more importance to American Jews than it otherwise would have been begins with them looking at this story of the Maccabees who defeated an oppressor who was trying to wipe out Judaism, who rededicated the temple in Jerusalem and restored Judaism, really, so that it could go on. And this emerged first in a hymnal written by a woman named Penina Moiza, who lived in Charleston, South Carolina. And she used the image of this purified temple as a way for Jews to consider how God would forgive their sins and purify their souls, which is an entirely novel way of using the story of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not typically a time when we ask for the forgiveness of sins, but that's what she's doing because she's living in a part of the country in South Carolina that was at that time undergoing waves of evangelical enthusiasm when people around her were being urged to consider their sins and ask God's forgiveness and find their way to Jesus. And so what Moiza is doing with her Hanukkah hymn is giving Jews a way to use the Hanukkah story as a way to resolve the same kinds of questions that their neighbors are looking at about God's forgiveness of them, but without turning to anything in Christianity, remaining within the Jewish story. And I thought that was remarkable.
Yeah. Rabbi Nafshi, you want to jump in?
I have a question for you. I'm familiar a little bit with Penina Moises and her compositions. Do you think it's possible that sin that she was also referring to has to do with living in a slave state in the time that she lived, and particularly because her congregation was where American Reform Judaism was born? Most of Reform Judaism came from Germany, except for the experiment really in South Carolina, and they were a little bit more progressive than a lot of the other Jewish communities in the South, and I'm wondering if that played into it at all.
Yeah, what do you think, Professor?
If slavery played into it?
Or perhaps the maybe guilt feelings or feelings of maybe there's something wrong about this.
That's a new reading to me. I have no, there's no mention of slavery at all. In fact, in any of her hymns. I mean, she wrote almost all of this new hymnal that was used by this congregation. And you're right, it's the first Reform congregation in the country. And their complaint when they petitioned the congregation and broke away from it to form this new congregation, their complaint was that they just didn't understand Hebrew any longer, and they needed things in English, and they wanted the services shortened. And so for them, it was that they had grown so far from Jewish traditions that they really couldn't make heads or tails of them any longer, and they needed a change for themselves. There's really no mention of slavery in any of the documents about that congregation and that new group that Moisa was writing for.
I want to ask you a quick question, too, Rabbi Nafshi. You know, there has been a lot about the closeness of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving this year, and you talked about that Hanukkah kind of evolved from this fall harvest festival called Sukkot. Sounds a lot like Thanksgiving.
Well, and there is a theory that the pilgrims, before they came to the United States, well, this is history, that they were in Holland. And while they were in Holland, that it's quite possible that they observed their Jewish neighbors celebrating the festival of Sukkot. And so when they came to the United States, they too wanted to offer their gratitude and thanksgiving to God for the bounty that they had received, much like they had seen the Jews of Holland do.
Wow, that's really interesting. And as we continue our conversation, we'll hear more and more stories like this. I think about one religion borrowing from another, one culture kind of looking over children going, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that. All right, a lot more after a short break. We'll start taking your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We'll be right back.
Get home as fast as you can. Doing the can-can. Hanukkah Harry, he is the man. Oh, everyone's here. It's Hanukkah.
All right. In February.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More in the history of Hanukkah in America on The Exchange, then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, new efforts to limit NSA surveillance powers. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from New Hampshire Liquor and Wine Outlets, offering holiday gift-giving ideas of wine and spirits, including a selection of more than 7,000 wines in 77 stores located throughout New Hampshire. From the Flying Monkey in Plymouth, presenting Christmas with Natalie McMaster on December 5th, and the Newtopians, a John Lennon experience on the 6th, tickets at flyingmonkeynh.com. And R.H. Irving Home Builder, specializing in sustainable, eco-friendly homes, free of fossil fuels, and utilizing continuous fresh air ventilation. Details at rhirvinghomebuilders.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the history of Hanukkah in America, the eight-day Jewish festival of lights, known by the general public for its candles and dreidels, is an ancient celebration of religious freedom and a miracle. Now, the author of a new book offers a uniquely American take on this holiday and how in this country it was transformed from a minor festival to a major occasion. We're talking about that this hour, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Do you celebrate Hanukkah? If so, how has it evolved in your own home? Do you think, like Christmas, the Festival of Lights has become too commercial? And how will you be observing Thanksgivica this year, given the holiday mashup that we're hearing about, Thanksgiving Eve also being the first night of Hanukkah. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Diane Ashton is with us, professor of religious studies at Rowan University. She's author of the new book, Hanukkah in America. Rabbi Robin Nashi is with us in studio. She's rabbi of Temple Beth Jacob in Concord. And both of you, let's go to our callers now. And Tanya's been waiting in Bedford. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air.
Hi,
go ahead.
You?
Good, good.
My story is probably a little unique in that I am not Jewish. My family is not Jewish. And we have been celebrating Hanukkah for many, many years now.
And why is that, Tanya?
It's kind of a long story, but I'm really drawn to the story of Hanukkah. And I think that there's something that we can all learn from it. And I remember when my children were smaller, it was really about the rededication of the temple. And it was about just the miracle and how children are miracles. And there's miracles in our lives every day and how we should be more aware of them. And we should be grateful for what we have. But now that I have a teenage son and a tweener daughter, it's much more about the struggle of the Maccabees. That, you know, there's hard days, life isn't always easy, but you just have to keep in the fight, you have to keep at it, you have to be strong, and there's a better day ahead. You know, they had faith in their God, they had faith in each other, they had faith in their community, and they achieved a great thing. And I think that there's so many layers to Hanukkah, and it's just interesting to see how it's evolved for us.
Lot of great themes there. Absolutely. I just want to ask you real quickly, Tanya, if I could, do you also observe Christmas?
Yes. My husband and I were raised Catholic.
Okay.
So we are from a Christian background, and yeah, we do celebrate Christmas.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Tanya. And boy, both of you, I think I'll turn to you first, Professor Ashton. The Maccabees. We talked about them a little bit before, but just remind us who they were. And then you write in your book that they've gotten some varied treatment by Americans of the Jewish faith over the years. But just remind us first, Professor Ashton, who they were.
Well, the Maccabees were the people who actually led the fight of the Jews against the Assyrians. And they were the ones who were in charge of rededicating the temple after it was able to be retaken from the Assyrian forces. And so they became an amazing model for Jewish leadership, courage, dedication, commitment. And those ideas became really key for American Jews to consider for the last 200 years of their time in the U.S., that model has been something that American Jews have turned to and kind of reshaped in the ways that they needed it in many different eras. But your caller is correct. That model has been very important to American Jews.
Now, how did they reshape it in different eras? Because you do write about that, how in some eras of American history, the Maccabees were more prominent than in other eras.
Well, in the 19th century, what was happening in the U.S. was that there was a real debate going on between rabbis and religious leaders, Jewish religious leaders, over how would Judaism survive in the U.S. and which approach to Judaism should take the lead? Who would be an authentic leader of Jewish life in the U.S. because of separation of church and state and because the reform movement was just beginning and because we had very, very few actually ordained rabbis in the country, leadership was really up for grabs and it was an open debate. And so as that debate evolved, and this took place in the Jewish press, so that readers were very much aware of the positions of various people who were trying to claim leadership, the image of the Maccabees became more and more important because each side in that debate claimed to be Maccabees for the modern era.
Maccabees for the modern era. What does that mean, Professor Ashton?
That they were now the models of the people who would be able to lead Jews in America, that their dedication, their commitment, their clarity, their sense of what the right thing to do was, that they should be listened to, and they had earned the right to
be the leaders of American Judaism going forward.
You know, it's tricky, isn't it, Rabbi Nafshi? You said in our first segment that some Jews don't like this idea of celebrating a big, nasty war.
They don't. And those who know the history as well also know that the Maccabees, or the descendants, the Hasmoneans, who put themselves into power after the rededication of the temple and claimed the throne of the priesthood, were quite controversial as well in what they did. And in fact, many, and I believe Professor Ashton writes about this quite clearly, that many believe that that whole imposition of themselves into power eventually led to the war with Rome and the destruction of the temple in 70, and that it was sort of the beginning of the downfall. So they're not without their own controversy.
How do you talk about the Maccabees in your own temple?
Both interesting people in history, but also people that we can model ourselves after when we want to stand up for something. And certainly being here in New Hampshire, where there is not a very large Jewish community, our kids do unfortunately face taunts and bullying and outright anti-Semitism. And
still, in this day and age.
They do, unfortunately. And so the Maccabees can be for them a model of heroism and pride, and particularly if we focus on what they stood for, which was religious freedom. And that's what our kids, too, want to be able to take that and stand proud as Jews in an area where they're such a small, small, small minority.
Yeah, and it's interesting what Tanya says about how even though she is not Jewish, they were raised Catholic, both she and her husband. She loves some of the themes, you know, the idea of a miracle, the idea of gratefulness, and what you just said, Rabbi Nafshi, you know, that the Maccabees can provide an inspiration to young people and to all of us who face certain struggles. What about in Israel? I mean, well, is this whole story, you know, not even relevant in Israel?
No,
how do they interpret it?
Hanukkah is absolutely observed in Israel. It's observed across the world. The United States is probably the only place where it has been elevated to the
rockstar status.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Actually, in Israel, there's some beautiful aspects of the celebration. Many people will have a glass box outside their home during the holiday. It almost looks like a clear mailbox, if you can visualize, but tall enough to fit a menorah in it. And so they light the candles and literally have them outside. And so when I lived in Israel and would walk through the streets of Jerusalem during Hanukkah, it was absolutely gorgeous to see all these menorahs lit throughout the community. So,
wow.
Eating of fried foods, of course, is one of the features of Hanukkah, and that's because of the miracle of the oil. So we eat things fried in oil. And in this country, those are latkes, potato pancakes. In Israel, they're mostly what we call sufganiyot, which are basically jelly donuts. So you go into the bakeries during Hanukkah, and everything has sort of been removed from the counters, and all you see are donuts after donuts after donuts. But it is certainly a minor festival. There's not gift giving. My friends in Europe tell me that there's really not gift giving associated with it in Europe as well. But the Maccabees and the image of the Maccabees is also one that has taken on a huge role in Israel, and a controversial one somewhat. After the Holocaust, those Jews who were already living in pre-state Israel in Palestine and didn't really understand what the European Jews had gone through and were to some degree actually quite embarrassed by survivors in their midst and asked them why you couldn't have been more like Maccabees and fighting back. And so many of the pre-state Palestine Jews interpreted and took on the idea that these other Jews should have been like Maccabees and strong. Obviously, over time, as they really learned the history of the Holocaust and what happened, they relented a little bit. But there is a city in Israel between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv called Modi'in. And Modi'in is historically the city from where the Maccabees came. It's probably somewhere near the area, but whether it's the exact spot, we'll never know. But the city was created in particular to sort of to pay homage to the Maccabees and what that means. And Israel is a largely secular society. There is certainly a strong religious element, but they're a distinct minority. It's really more of the secular Jews who dominate the society. And so a city itself to be named for the Maccabees is an extraordinary way to speak of the place they hold in Jewish history.
Wow, that's really interesting. So to hear Tanya, our caller, and also Professor Ashton say that, you know, oftentimes American Jews have used the Maccabees as a source of inspiration to help you through struggle. But I almost felt sick, Rabbi Nashi, when you talked about Jews in Palestine, pre-Israel Palestine, kind of blaming those Jews from Europe who had escaped and saying, why weren't you more like Maccabees? That seems to me to be an abuse of the Maccabee legacy.
I think
or using it in a very mean way.
I think it also just came from a place of deep misunderstanding and misinformation. And I think over history, they certainly dropped the attitude. But it really came from an embarrassment initially about what had happened in the war when they were really not aware of the extent to which the Nazi machine was operating.
Wow. All right. Well, again, if you want to join us with your thoughts, questions, comments about Hanukkah, how it has evolved in this country, if you have questions about the history of Hanukkah in America, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests are Rabbi Robin Nafshi of Temple Beth Jacob in Concord and Professor Diane Ashton. She's a professor of religious studies at Rowan University. Her brand new book is Hanukkah in America, A History. One more time, that number is 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Ashton, let's get a little bit more into this theme of how Hanukkah evolved in America. It was interesting to hear Rabbi Nafshi say, you know, yes, it's observed elsewhere, but nowhere else does it have the rock star status that it does in the United States. When and how did all that get started, Professor Ashton?
Well, we have to recognize that holidays are big business in the U.S. And so holidays that had any remote possibility of being linked to gift-giving and buying things really were going to blossom in the U.S. at the same time that consumerism and a consumer economy really took off, which was in the late 19th century. That's when we begin to see Christmas presents becoming widespread, Christmas trees, and goods, buying stuff for your house and for your family. And Jews adapted that. And the first place that it was adapted really were in what we call the ethnic economy, that is, small businesses that really catered, owned by Jews, that really catered to Jews. So stores that sold Judaica, menorahs, and candles. The first Hanukkah greeting cards were created by an organization called the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods. And this was a women's organization who arranged with a company that sold Christmas greeting cards to adapt a couple of designs for use at Hanukkah. And then the sisterhoods nationwide sold these greeting cards in their congregations as a way to raise money for their organization. So it actually begins within the Jewish community. And the final piece in that, of course, is that rabbis and parents urged each other to give gifts to children at Hanukkah so that they would not be unhappy and envious at Hanukkah because their Christian friends were getting gifts, and they wanted Jewish children to be happy to be Jews at this time of year when Christmas was getting so much play and Christian children were being indulged.
And we all know that story, right? Exactly. But you got to love capitalism.
Oh, yeah.
Rabbi Nashi. Yeah. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I always frame it as Hanukkah achieved its status as the Jewish Christmas so that our Jewish kids could go back to school after the first of the year and talk about the gifts that they got, too.
Over eight days, not just one day.
Yeah, right.
And has it succeeded? And how do you feel about it being called sort of the Jewish Christmas, Rabbi Nashi?
I don't like it being called the Jewish Christmas. Yeah. I think it's its own holiday. It stands on its own. I do think that we as Jews have adopted from the dominant culture in every society in which we've lived, in every era in which we've lived. And if we can take the best of what American society offers and weave it into Hanukkah, that's great. I worry about both Hanukkah and Christmas and the over-commercialization and, you know, Black Friday, where it used to be everything was closed and it was just a nice long weekend for everybody. And now it's all about sales, sales, sales. And I feel for people who work in the retail industry where they don't get the four-day weekend or the extra day off and all the people who will be lined up to shop. It's, you know, that's more of a statement on America than on Christmas and Hanukkah, but so be it. That's where we live.
All right. Let's take another call if we could. And Elaine's waiting in Hudson. Hi, Elaine. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling really to, I'm a lady of a certain age, and I wanted to tell you about the difference between when I was a child and we got something we needed for a Hanukkah gift, and now that children get something that they want, and something that our family has done to kind of change it up. And that is that we give each of our grandchildren a gift certificate, and they can redeem that for a donation to the charity of their choice.
And that's what they do for Hanukkah.
Right. That's our gift to them.
Yeah.
What their parents do for them is a whole other adventure.
And what is that adventure? I'm curious, Elaine.
Well, they get the usual gifts. I will say that I'm pleased that my daughters have not gone to the crazy, huge gifts. There's usually something small for most nights and one quote, important gift that they give their children. We have a huge menorah that we light in our sunroom so that people coming by can see it, so that we have a light in the window every night for eight nights. And we always retell the story.
Yeah, and last question for you, if I could, Elaine. Are you sort of mashing up the holidays, Thanksgiving and Hanukkah? What are you going to do about that?
I don't like that mashing term.
We're combining them
simply because they are coexisting this year. I'm not crazy about the whole Thanksgivica idea, but certainly it's a great opportunity for us because we will have all of our family together at the same time, which as your children get older and have their own families, that becomes more difficult.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Elaine. And I won't say happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank
I'll say
you.
Happy Thanksgiving
Thank
and happy Hanukkah.
You too. Have a wonderful holiday.
Thanks a lot for calling in. And we will get more of your thoughts after a super short break. Also talking more about the history of Hanukkah in America, how this holiday has been uniquely interpreted by American Jews. Short break coming up, and we'll be right back.
Kid in town without a Christmas tree. Here's a list of people who are Jewish, just like you and me. David Lee Roth lights the menorah. So do James Conkirk Douglas and the late Dinah Shore. Guess who eats together at the Carnegie Deli? Bowser from Shanana and Arthur Fonzarelli.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new efforts to limit NSA's surveillance powers, then research on video games and mental health. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Comcast Business, supporting New Hampshire Food Bank's collection of non-perishable food items at the New Hampshire for the Holidays Expo December 7th and 8th, more at eventsnh.com. And the Brattleboro Retreats Emerging Adult Program, providing specialized mental health and addiction care for people ages 18 to 29, online at BrattleboroRetreat.org. It is 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, special Thanksgiving programming from NHPR and NPR. Join us tomorrow for that. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the unique history of Hanukkah in America, how American Jews have, over the course of 200 years, made this a uniquely American holiday. You can join us with your questions, thoughts, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. If you're Jewish, do you celebrate Hanukkah? How have you seen that celebration evolve over time in your own family? Do you think, like Christmas, the Festival of Lights has become too commercial? And what do you think about the confluence of Thanksgiving and Hanukkah this year? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Professor Diane Ashton, Rabbi Robin Nafshi, we were talking about this a little bit before the break, and I want to go there again. This is the idea of how American Jews, influenced by the dominant Christian culture and also a capitalist culture, have changed Hanukkah. But you write, Diane, Hanukkah offers a way to resolve the ambiguity of being an American Jew. I find that a really interesting sentence. What does that mean? What's that ambiguity all about?
Well, the ambiguity is that we are Americans, but the country primarily throughout most of its history has been overwhelmingly dominated by Christians. Certainly in the colonial era, more than 90% of Americans were Christian, and it's still over 70% of Americans who are Christian. And so Christian ideas and Christian culture have had a huge impact on American culture. So how do Jews fit into that? How does that work? What should we do to be Americans? And yet, how should we resist becoming Christians? And how do we enjoy freedom of religion to be Jews in this country? And so Hanukkah gives us a way to kind of play out those ambiguities and those questions and come to some kind of resolution, because it's a way to do a Jewish celebration with true Jewish meaning and a Jewish history and following Jewish rules. But at the same time, because it occurs in people's homes, I mean, this is a holiday that's celebrated at home primarily. People are really free to adapt it to their own families' tastes and styles and sensibilities. Very recently, in the last few decades, it's also become very popular to have Hanukkah events at Jewish museums, Jewish community centers, and synagogues. But it's primarily a domestic occasion, and that gives people a lot of freedom to work things out for themselves.
I definitely want to ask you about that domestic element, because you write a lot about it, and as you say, it's important. But first, that point that Professor Ashton makes of Rabbi Nafshi, it helps. She really makes an interesting point. Hanukkah has helped over the many years of American history. It's helped American Jews kind of, I don't know how else to put it, fit in but also remain different.
Absolutely. We have our own holiday, very different from, very, very different from Christmas and the way it's observed. Yet it, because it usually falls around the Christmas time, we feel very American. I mean, in that we're celebrating something.
You're not completely left out.
Right. And you know, there are the great debates even about when you walk into a merchant store, and let's imagine a year in which Hanukkah is later than it will be this year, and you're greeted with a happy holidays versus a Merry Christmas, and who's being offended, who's being included, who's being embraced, who's being left out. But the fact that that debate even exists tells us that we've achieved something by making our mark, and that there's a recognition that there are others other than Christians in our society, and they're celebrating something too.
Over both of your lives, Professor Ashton and Rabbi Nafshi, how have you seen this change? I'll go to you first, Rabbi Nafshi. This idea that Hanukkah is separate and distinct, and we should keep it that way, and it's not important, it's a minor holiday, to this idea of, yeah, it's okay, that way everybody can be celebrating.
It's certainly...
Is there some conflict there, you know?
It is,
or was there?
Yes and no. I mean, I think in part you had, I mean, I, I'm 53, so growing up in the 60s and 70s and how we celebrated, like the last caller, certainly I received gifts I needed. You know, it was classic. What did you get for Hanukkah that night? I got socks. You know, the gifts that you needed, and then maybe one night you got something that was going to be fun and enjoyable. But it was very much small and observed within our home, our family, you know, maybe a mention of it at synagogue, just a kind of happy Hanukkah.
Just a mention at synagogue.
Yeah,
you don't have like a big Christmas Eve.
No.
Everybody goes to church on Christmas Eve if you're Christian.
No. There's really nothing to, I mean, certainly we add a couple of prayers or light the menorah during a Hanukkah service. We will do that if we have a meeting or a class or a Sabbath service during Hanukkah, we certainly incorporate candle lighting into it. But other than that, there's nothing really special that we do for Hanukkah and never have. But the dominant culture has just become much more aware of it. And so I certainly have seen that change. I mean, when I was a kid, I certainly imagined when I went to a mall in mid-December, the only greeting you would have ever heard would have been Merry Christmas. And the fact that mostly you hear now Happy Holidays just tells us where it has become in our conscience.
What do you think, Professor Ashton? How have you seen this change over your own lifetime?
Oh, very similar to what the rabbi is describing. I grew up in Buffalo, and so I got a lot of sweaters for Hanukkah.
Doesn't sound like you wanted all those sweaters.
Yeah, well, I used them in Buffalo. I wore them. But my parents did make a big deal out of Hanukkah because there were only 10 Jewish students in my entire grade at school. It was a very Catholic area, and so, you know, Catholics have a good time on Christmas celebrations. And so my parents wanted me to be sure that I enjoyed Hanukkah. But it was very small. It was something that went on in our house. Synagogue would, you know, at religious school, there would certainly be a mention of it. There would probably be a Hanukkah party in the religious school for the school children. But there wasn't much more to it than that. But parents were always concerned about, how are you doing? What are we doing for our children at this time of year? And they were very anxious. What are they saying in school? Are you being taught too much about Christianity? I mean, parents were concerned that their children not be indoctrinated with Christian ideas during that time of the year when public school, at least in my part of the world, did have a lot of Christmas activities.
You know, it's interesting. Go ahead, Rabbi Nashi. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, we're probably of that era when the Christmas concert at our schools that we were probably mandated to sing in, they started adding, you know, one little Hanukkah-related song. And so every kid of our age group knew how to sing I Have a Little Dreidel or something.
But that's it. That's all you get.
And then we did, you know, 12 Christmas songs.
Well, and it's interesting to hear Professor Ashton say this. You know, she said there are very few Jews where she grew up in Buffalo. What's the difference, Rabbi Nafshi? You've lived around the country. What's the difference between observing Hanukkah maybe in New Jersey or New York, where there are lots of Jews, and in Texas, where there are probably far fewer?
Well, I happen to have grown up in North Jersey, where there were very few Jews, one of the only towns. And my class was even smaller than Professor Ashton's. I think I had 7 or 8 Jewish kids in my class. So my experience was much like hers. But having lived in New York City and larger cities, it when you have people who understand and know a lot about Hanukkah, they're more apt to ask you about it. What are you doing?
Right.
But there still is a lot of misinformation, and I'm always amused by the numbers of people who will say, and trying to be sensitive, oh, well, I'm sure you can't attend a meeting then. It's during Hanukkah. Or, I don't want to impose on you during that week. It's during Hanukkah, and really, it's not that important a holiday. I do go to meetings. I eat regular meals. I do everything that I would normally do the rest of the year. And so, we've come to a place that those people who want to be sensitive about it have now elevated it into something far grander than it is. You know, if you ask a Jew what the most important holiday is, depending on their orientation, they may say Passover, they may say Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, they may even say Shabbat, the Sabbath, but very rarely will they say Hanukkah once they've passed the age of maybe 15. And the gifts, they realize, is just something. But nevertheless, the rest of the world still thinks of it as such an important holiday. So I don't know. I guess maybe we've excessively achieved with Hanukkah.
Or achieved, but to the point where people aren't focused on, right, the holiday. And you're right, from a religious perspective, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, a lot more important. And people may be unknowingly, not trying to be rude, inviting you to events and meetings during that time. I mean, I couldn't even tell you when those times are. I know they're in the fall. Plus, the dates always change. Every year it's different. It's not like December 25th. October 31st.
Well, the date never changes if you look at the Hebrew calendar. See, Hanukkah is always the 25th of Kislev. Just so happens in relation to the Gregorian calendar, it obviously moves all the time.
Thank you for calling me out on that.
It's lunar calendar
versus
solar calendar. We obviously don't live by the lunar calendar, so we're not familiar with that.
You know, Diane Ashton, I know you have to go soon. A couple other interviews, since this is a big day for you and your book, given that it's Thanksgiving and the first night of Hanukkah. Final thoughts from you, Professor Ashton. What's the one takeaway that you really want people to get from this book that you've written?
I think that holidays evolve, and that's what happens. If a holiday is going to remain relevant to a community, they have to continually make it relevant in each generation and each era that people experience. Hanukkah has been adapted to speak to whatever it is those people were going through at that time. And for American Jews, that means that Hanukkah becomes a way to be both Jewish and American in all the complexities that means.
Have you gotten any feedback from anybody, Professor Ashton, who says, look, why did you write a whole book about Hanukkah? I mean, as Rabbi Nofsi just said, Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah are a lot more important.
Oh, during the time that I was writing it, people thought I was insane. Because,
really? Why?
Yeah, because some people thought, oh, well, that'll be interesting, but they couldn't really quite imagine how. But I had many people who tell me that, you know, why are you writing about Hanukkah? It's not an important holiday. It's, you know, it's just commerce. But I thought it was much more interesting than that.
Well, good luck with the book, and thank you very much for joining us today. We know you're busy.
Thanks so much to you.
That's
Bye-bye.
Professor Diane Bye. Ashton. She's a professor of religious studies at Rowan University, author of four books, most recently, as we said, Hanukkah in America, History. She also edits the scholarly journal American Jewish History. I have a couple more questions for you, Rabbi Nofsi, as we finish out. What do you think about what she just said? She got some feedback. Why are you even writing about Hanukkah?
Oh, I would have expected that. Fully. Although it makes a lot of sense in America that you would, because it is the holiday most recognized by non-Jewish Americans. They'll tell you, many who are not familiar with Judaism and Jewish religion and our holidays, they'll assume that Hanukkah is the most important holiday, and so it would be natural. But I also think that as a historian, as she is a historian, it is a fascinating evolution of how it is observed and celebrated in this country. And the idea that we so borrow from the dominant culture and the dominant culture borrows from us. I mean, that first caller, who she and her Roman Catholic-raised husband, both of them being Catholic, but they celebrate Hanukkah, that first surprised me. And then when I thought more about it, there are a number of communities where 13-year-old non-Jewish children are asking for something like a bar or bat mitzvah because they find it really a kind of fascinating passage, sort of a recognition of that particular time of really moving from a middle schooler into a high schooler and that transition. So again, as we borrow from the dominant culture, then the dominant culture borrows back from us. And it's in many ways, it's a some people might find it horrifying, but others might find it a way of the greatest compliment is imitation.
Imitation is the finest form of flattery.
Something
like that.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I do wonder about that. I mean, again, you are, a religious leader in your community. A purist might say, Rabbi Nofsi, and this is in any religion, not just Jewish, a holiday is a holiday is a holiday. It should be what it is at its core. You know, and this idea of making it relevant, making it fit in, adapting to the times, adapting to the culture, you know, a purist might say, you know, fooey on that.
It depends on what you mean by a purist, and I might argue that there is no such thing as a purist as far as Judaism is concerned, other than, I mean, every one of our holidays has been adapted and has evolved over time. If we look at the way biblically we celebrated or observed Yom Kippur, it was done with sacrifices in the temple. Now, obviously, with the destruction of the temple and the end of the sacrificial system, it had to be adapted and changed. And it was. And although there's very little that changes from Yom Kippur, simply because we're in synagogue all day praying, and there are certainly small liturgical changes that have taken place over time. Passover is a great example of where we have made changes. You know, the requirement at Passover is to retell the story of the Exodus from Egypt, use it symbolically with different foods, with wine or juice. But it's the telling of the story. And every generation again and every people tell the story differently. Many families make up their own what is called a Haggadah, which contains the story. But if you were to go to a Jewish bookstore and look at the options one has for a Haggadah during Passover, there's the vegetarian version and the one that is sensitive to the Paschal lamb or the slaying of the animal. There is very popular in the 70s was one that was filled with poetry and readings about Soviet Jewry and the American Jewish community and others who were trying hard to allow the Soviet Jews to leave the Soviet Union. Elie Wiesel wrote one that's a sort of a Holocaust. So it commemorates the Holocaust and has readings from that time. And so, again, it can always be adapted to fit the culture, the time, the place, and what's relevant to people.
And we've done this forever.
Forever.
Yeah. So I can say happy Thanksgiving to you.
You can to me.
All right. You won't be offended.
Not in the least.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
It's been really fun.
Thank you, and happy holidays to you as well.
Rabbi Robin Nafshi, Rabbi of Temple Beth Jacob in Concord. We spoke earlier with Professor Diane Ashton. Again, her new book is Hanukkah in America, A History. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy. When you need him.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I remember a lot of happy Thanksgivings. My dad was mostly the cook, but my mom was mostly the hurrier of the cook.
Julia Sweeney takes time to share warm memories with you this Thanksgiving. And we'll gather together the wit of Anne Lamott, the wisdom of Ted Kooser, and grateful music from Dawn Upshaw. I'm John Burge with music and stories for Thanksgiving. It's Giving Thanks from American Public Media.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 959. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and the Spine Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Using research results to build customized treatment plans, information at dhspine.org. And Courier Museum of Art in Manchester presenting Signs from the 60s, Robert Indiana's Decade, featuring works by the creator of the iconic Love Stamp. Opens today. Details at courier.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The Senate Intelligence Committee has ratified a bill that allows the NSA to continue bulk collection of phone records. But the bill imposes new rules as to when these records can be reviewed. Some members from both parties think the proposed reform